called Conscious Food, which is all about eating food which basically is rejecting the transnational companies, GMOs, all the chemicals, and we're trying to eat organic, natural food, vegetarian food with less environmental impact. We're doing this as a community kitchen. Every day we're running with lunch and dinner, as also it's a way of bringing everyone together around communities.
Bueno, me llamo Ariel de la Rocha.
My name is Ariel de la Rocha from Bolivia. I am from the movement called Conscious Food.
Empezó a partir de nosotros como activistas.
So the movement of Conscious Food began with a group of us climate change activists realizing the relationship between decisions we made about food and its impact on climate change. With our activism around climate change, we started to distribute more healthy food and put aside food products that emit more greenhouse gases. In this sense, we started to be involved with this house and part of the Active Earth Bolivia movement and to initiate actions around the COP and the People's Summit.
Voices from the Tierra Activa Convergence Space here in Lima, Peru. Tune in tomorrow for coverage of today's Climate March. Democracy Now! Is produced by a remarkable crew. Mike Burke, Renee Feltz-Aramate, Nirmi Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Ravi Karan, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Dennis Moynihan, Clara Ibarra, Andres Contreras, John Hamilton, and Chuck Skurich. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with host Paul Rowland. Today's guest is Ted Gleichman of the Sierra Club, and we'll talk about the proposed Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas export facility and the pipeline that would feed it. Should we really pipe fracked gas through Oregon to a terminal in Coos Bay and export it to Asia?
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
K-B-O-O
Portland. Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Hi, this is Sun Lee, the membership coordinator at KBOO Community Radio. I just want to take a moment to say thank you to all the people that made our three-day December drive a rousing success. From our volunteers that answered phones, created great programs, and engineered live music, and to all of our listeners that called in or donated online, and to the restaurants that donated food for our volunteers. I would also like to thank and welcome the 40-plus new members to the KBOO community. Without your support, KBOO would not be what it is today. Thank you.
The gas that powers your town that wills fracked, yeah, totally fracked.
But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow. With names like benzene and formaldehyde, you better keep them far away from the water supply.
The drillers say the fishes are a mile below the groundwater pumped into American homes. But don't tell it to the residents of Sublayo that water's fracked. We're talking benzene.
What the frack is going on?
So it all goes back to 2005.
Okay. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. I am your host, Paul Rowland. And that was the fracking song. As they were just about to say, it goes back to 2005 and Bush and Cheney and their energy plan that was oh so disastrous to all life on this planet and the lives of many people across the country suffering from whether it's gas fracking or oil fracking in North Dakota, offshore oil. Extreme energy is the last resort of a desperate system trying to save itself. And as you heard Steve say, we do have Ted Gleichman on the line. But if you'll hold on a second, Ted, I just got a few announcements for upcoming events, which I got off of Activate Hub Portland. That's a, you can go to that calendar. It's portland.activatehub.org. And that's got a calendar of all the activist events or all the ones that get put up there. And you can put yours up there, too. So today is the public premiere of De-Gentrifying Portland, 7 p.m. at the Rosewood Initiative, 16126. That's 16126 Southeast Stark. That's join Know Your City Portland African American Leadership Forum along with artist and project coordinator Sharita Town for the public premiere of short films made by local youth of color that address the topic of gentrification and changing neighborhoods in Portland, also filmed by other artists from Portland on similar themes. And again, that repeats Saturday. It was variously reported as 2 or 4 p.m., so you might want to double-check that. And that Saturday event is at closer in Portland, Sons of Haiti Lounge Lodge at 3503 North Mississippi. That's Saturday. So today and Saturday, De-Gentrifying Portland, and that's up at Activate Hub Portland. Today is Global Human Rights Day, one event that's happening is it's Salem at the Riverfront Carousel Park and Fountains. Don't Shoot Portland and Allies will be gathering from 12:30 to 3:30 today. And also, I believe at the City Council starts at 2:00. There's going to be testimony on this hotly contested issue of body cams for police. Now, I know there's been a lot of talk out there about the benefits of that, but there's a lot of pushback too, people saying that's just this technological fix that doesn't really address the issue of police oversight and accountability. So you can go and hear and put in your two cents. I believe it's also streamed live. I'm not sure where, but I'm sure you can find out easily. And this evening, the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines will hold a cultural event For Whom We Rise Together, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Portland State Native American Student and Community Center, which is kind of up there, sort of on the other side from downtown of the main PSU campus, kind of up, tucked up along the highway. So that's happening, and there's going to be a bunch of different groups doing various musical skits. Too many groups to name. Tomorrow at the is KBU Night at the Clinton Street Theater. 5 Broken Cameras, 7 p.m. about the nonviolent resistance movement in Palestine. Also tomorrow, 11:30 a.m. in the Park Blocks, a rally against the pending decision whether or not to let police on the Portland State Police. Carry firearms. That's a big issue for students at Portland State. You might want to consider checking that one out. And Friday, 7 p.m., Shadows of Liberty at the Oregon Labor Center, 3645 Southeast 32nd Avenue, The Truth Behind News Media Censorship. That's a film. So that's a lot of stuff. Again, that's all at portland.activatehub.org's calendar, which I think is also linked to via the KBU website, which is kboo.fm. So thank you for bearing with me, Ted.
My pleasure, Paul, and thank you for rolling out that well-crafted reminder of all the many opportunities we have to work for positive social change in Portland.
And beyond. And so we are speaking with Ted Gleichman, who is with Sierra Club, And you are the editor, I believe, of this publication, The Climate Impacts of Natural Gas Production and LNG Export, A Synopsis of Current Science, just recently released. Is this true?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it's been quite the project, and we're getting really good response to it, both in Oregon and around the country, because it is one of the most misunderstood issues around gas. The myth, as it turns out, is that natural gas is better than other fossil fuels in the context of what we're facing with climate disruption and the gradual degradation of a livable climate. Not true. It's just another dirty fossil fuel, and we can talk about that in as much detail as you want.
But, Well, the first question on the list was actually, what is, and I put the term so-called in front of natural gas, just because natural gas, it already sounds kind of warm and fuzzy and eco-friendly. So what is so-called natural gas?
It is both organic and gluten-free.
So what is this stuff that people talk about as the transition solution to a non heavily dependent fossil fuel economy, not heavily dependent on fossil fuels? What is natural gas?
Natural gas is, well, it's one of the best rebrandings in history. Before mining of natural gas started, it was known generally as swamp gas, biogenic gas that's been created in our lifetimes and in recent memory, as distinguished from the antique that gets mined. But there's two basic definitions of it, and the distinction is important because it directly affects the severe risks that Oregon will be put to if the energy industry and the 1% get their way here with the two big projects that are underway. And Jordan Cove is the one that's up first in Coos Bay, but there's another one in Warrenton, Astoria, with pipelines to feed it as well, called Oregon LNG. So the first of the two definitions of natural gas I call wellhead gas. At the site, gas is a mixture of gaseous hydrocarbons. It's predominantly methane. I think a lot of people know at this point that natural gas is essentially methane. But at the wellhead, it's a mix. Anybody who watches Sunday morning TV sees the tall blonde lady in the gray suit talking about how wonderful our gas glut is and the fracking opportunities are. I love that song, by the way. Thank you very much for, I love hate that song. Thanks for leading off with that this morning. And she shows a picture of the happy green plants and the beautiful brown topsoil and the nice little straight line below the plants and the happy city in the background, and then a beautiful blue aquifer, and then a solid layer of safe, protected rock. And then below that, the shale that's just been waiting there for us to frack it and pull out the hydrocarbons in another nice, clean, smooth layer, completely separated from the pretty blue aquifer and the happy green plants. Well, that's not the way it looks in the Earth's crust. It's messy. It's full of cracks and fractures and uplifts and downslopes and fluids of all types moving around. And so the hydrocarbons have formed in lots of different ways. And gaseous hydrocarbons are always a mix. There's always more in it than just methane. Ethanes, butane, propane, more complex molecules like benzenes, often radon, the number two cause of lung cancer, and even mercury, other heavy metals. This wellhead gas then is moved by pipeline to a refinery.
Right, so right there you say refinery. So like when you say when the term natural gas, it virtually implies that this stuff just comes up bubbling out of the earth, just pure as can be, just ready to use. But no, it actually has to be refined.
Right,
and there's
the hydrocarbon equivalent of glacial spring water.
Right.
You know, just lean over and sip it. Yeah, no, that doesn't work. So and these LNG liquefied natural gas terminals are in fact refineries. And so at the refinery, the gas is broken. I mean, we have good technology on this. We have great engineers. The gas is broken into its component parts. And things like butane and propane are pulled out and repackaged for the market in other ways. Many of us have experienced that with lighters or backyard barbecues. So then... natural gas, definition number two, is essentially 100% methane with an odorant added, usually hydrogen sulfide, in a tiny, tiny percentage so that you can smell it if your pilot light blows out when you're getting ready to scramble your eggs and you can get out of your kitchen before the house blows up. So that's significant because these pipelines that they want to run through Oregon and Washington also in the case of the North Coast proposal are wellhead gas. And in fact, the guy running the North Coast proposal, Warrenton Astoria, when he does presentations, I don't know if he does anymore, but he would say, as he shows the map of this massive industrial plant, I mean, these terminals... we're not talking about sitting by the dock of the bay here. These are huge, massive industrial plants, two 20-story liquefaction towers, 100 feet across each, to store the liquefied natural gas. So, but he would say, and so here's where we process the gas, and over here is where we'll store the mercury that comes out of it, and people look at each other, mercury, you know. That's not good, is it? We really don't want mercury flowing through pipelines underneath our farms and forests, do we? So the wellhead gas is dangerous on many levels when it leaks. And just like with the big earthquake we're facing, it's when, not if, because these things always leak sooner or later, and many of them leak immediately. Something like 5 to 10% of all wells leak methane and the other components of gaseous hydrocarbons immediately, day one. And all wells fail in terms of preventing leakage eventually. And so in Colorado, for example, I moved to Oregon not quite 10 years ago from Colorado. I've spent a lot of time in the fracking fields of Colorado and Utah and Wyoming. And, you know, there's a permanent haze over the Front Range of Colorado now from Denver north to Fort Collins and Greeley from the constant leaks from the thousands and thousands of fracking wells that have been developed on the edge of the Front Range. And the same thing is happening. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, you know, like the big the haze that they discovered over Texas, which is just enormous, apparently.
And you're breathing that. It's... And, of course, it's contributing. These are all global warming gases, and so they're contributing to climate destruction in addition to contributing to asthma and other lung diseases and as it being absorbed into the bloodstream and just really not so good. So the issue with liquefied natural gas really comes back to the Cheney-Bush energy program of 2001. It's all about globalizing the gas market. Oil, and there are many forms of oil too, but oil is a liquid. It doesn't compress. Liquids don't compress. So the global market for oil moves it around in its more or less original state, you know, post-refinery. And before the refinery, where we've had these terrible explosions and fires are coming out of the Bakken field in North Dakota, which is a mixture of gaseous and liquid hydrocarbons, both. One of the reasons it's been so dangerous when it is put into trains for transport. Oil is moved in its original state. volume. So methane needs to be cooled to minus 261 degrees Fahrenheit to turn it into a liquid. That's the daily temperature average on Saturn. I mean, that's cold. So it takes a lot of energy to do that. And it reduces the volume to 1/600th, that's 0.06%, of its initial volume. Then you can put it in a tanker and move it across an ocean. And until people started liquefying it, the gas market was purely local and regional because it was all being moved by pipelines. Now, the long-term plan, and it's had some impact, is to develop a unified global market for the 1% of using liquefied natural gas as a way to equalize prices for this commodity. And the reason why we're on point and in the crosshairs of the rifle sights of the 1% here, the energy industry, I guess we should have there's a version of don't shoot that applies to this issue, as well as to the terrible abuses of human rights that we've seen in Ferguson and New York and other places, where maybe if we just raise our hands to the energy industry en masse and say don't shoot, they'll take us out of their crosshairs, or maybe not. So the challenge now is that gas in the U.S. is costs around $5 a unit. In Asia, it's often $16 to $20 a unit. It costs maybe $1.50 to get it across the ocean. There's plenty of room there to be able to finance a $6 or $7 billion project to be able, with 20 and 25 year contracts, to be able to move it across the ocean. And that number was with a B. It's just like the Keystone Pipeline. These are multi-billion-dollar projects.
Well, Ted, let's take a brief pause there. Let what you're saying sink in a little bit. And let me just let people know, this is Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowan. I'm speaking with Ted Gleichman of the Sierra Club, one of the people who've prepared and the editor of this new, brand new report, Climate Impacts of Natural Gas Production and LNG Export, a Synopsis of Current Science. And he is speaking from Roseburg, where he participated yesterday in a hearing that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, put on because they just released a few weeks ago their draft environmental impact statement on this Jordan Cove liquefied natural gas export facility and associated pipeline. And when we resume our conversation, we'll be talking about, you know, where this gas is coming from, where the pipeline route is proposed, what's been some of the responses at the first two hearings of this week-long set of hearings that FERC is conducting all around Oregon, and many more issues. But I would like to invite our callers to participate as well. And if you don't know the number, our studio line number is always 503-231-8187. You can use that to get to the DJs if you want to find out what music is playing, and find out what show just played, perhaps, and to call in on talk radio and other opportunities we give to participate in this participatory time from 8 to 9 every weekday morning on talk radio here on KBOO. So with that, let's sort of just step back. We can wind our way back to, you know, the issue of the refinery and liquefied natural gas, what the opposition is like in Coos Bay. But where is this gas going to come from? Where would it come from? I always like to use the conditional because, you know, we actually, a number of these other proposed facilities, both oil and coal, have actually been stopped in the Pacific Northwest. So there is some precedent for actually citizens having an impact on these major fossil fuel infrastructure projects. That's always important to keep in mind for those of you who don't necessarily want to see the Pacific Northwest turned into a fossil fuel corridor for export to other markets. So where would this gas come from?
This gas would come from the fracking fields of the Rockies and from Western Canada, the fracking fields of Alberta. It's a massive amount. The U.S. uses about 75 billion cubic feet of gas per day, and the proposal for Jordan Cove at Coos Bay and similarly for Warrenton Astoria would be over a billion feet a day each, and quite possibly up to 2 billion feet a day. So the two of them together, and along with proposals on the other coasts, amount ultimately potentially, the conditional is very good. Thanks for using the conditional, Paul. A lot of people don't, and we do need to maintain the hope that democracy and common sense can jointly prevail in this struggle.
Well, I like to say the future is unwritten, and nothing is certain in this world. You know, it's butterflies flapping their wings, after all, as they say. So if a butterfly flapping his wings can have such a huge impact, how about a bunch of people getting together and raising their voices? Anyway, continue with your overview of where this gas is coming from and how is it proposed to be to arrive at our doorstep here in Oregon.
So there's a strong network of pipelines along the West Coast now to move gas from the Rockies and from Canada. In fact, there was a major pipeline built that's directly relevant to this called the Ruby Pipeline that was just completed a few years ago, coming from a hub in Wyoming and terminating at Malin, Oregon, just east of Klamath Falls. And, that's a 42-inch pipeline that runs for 740 miles, I think, and through four states. Major, major project. And for Jordan Cove, the Canadian Energy Company that wants to export gas through Oregon without any direct benefit except for construction jobs, which is a direct benefit. We need to talk about that for a minute for sure.
What's the name of the company?
Veresen, V-E-R-E-S-E-N, so Veresen Energy, and we believe that a lot of their financing is coming from Asian billionaires, Asian investors at this point, because this gas would go to Asia, and so they want to run a 232-mile pipeline from Malin, Oregon, at the terminus of the Ruby Pipeline. It also connects to north-south pipelines run by TransCanada, which is, as we know, the proposer of the Keystone XL project, and 232 miles across four counties of southern Oregon, across the Coast Range, some of the most rugged parts, old-growth forests, across five rivers, the Rogue, the Umpqua twice, I think, Coquille, Coos, and some 400 other water courses and wetlands, and then terminate in the Coos Bay area, actually in North Bend, on a sand spit, in the biggest earthquake zone in North America, the very model for instability, there, after massive dredging of Coos Bay, these massive LNG tankers would come in and be loaded with the liquefied gas, and then head off.
Well, let's pause once again. We do have a caller, George. Go ahead. You're on the air. You got a question or comment?
Well, yeah, Jed, I'm a member of SSI here in Portland. SSI is Senior Studies Institute, We've been around since the late 80s. We have about 350 members. And we're always looking. I'm on the board and the curriculum committee, and we're always looking for speakers. And I wondered if you, Ted, would be able to join us for a class sometime in the winter term.
Well, that's very gracious. I'd love to. And, you know, thanks for sharing that with the many thousands of KBOO listeners, because it sounds like you've got a good thing going there.
Yeah, maybe George, you could maybe you have a comment or question for Ted. But if you don't, or after you do, you could stay on the line with Steve, our engineer, and leave your contact information.
Yeah, that's what I'd like to do. As terms of a question, between shipping coal, there's these 100 car coal trains across Oregon, and piping natural gas across Oregon. I just think we're just looking for a catastrophe.
Ted?
Couldn't agree more. The Bill McKibben makes the point. He phrases things carefully, like Paul, like you do with the conditional, quite appropriately. And his line is, to some degree, geography is destiny. And
I know he just got a Nobel Prize for his work. And with the environment, with 350.org. Well, if I could just talk to the engineer and leave a way for you to contact me, I'd be great.
Okay, Steve's shaking his head. Thank you, George.
Betcha.
And we have Sean also on the line. Go ahead, Sean.
Hey, good morning, you guys. Excuse me. I just briefly just wanted to make a comment that the media is not covering it all, at least only one side. And that is, if you're aware, the Coast Guard, under the premise of saying they're trying to save $6 million, are going to move their operations from Newport down to North Bend. But what they're not saying is, of course, is the reason they're moving it there is the expectation that Jordan Cove is going to go through and they're going to need him down there.
That's exactly right, and thank you for bringing that up.
The media doesn't say one thing about that. It's just that they're trying to save money. But the fact is, when you look at the need for the Coast Guard, and of course, the fishermen and the fishing boats are screaming and yelling about it, but they're determined that, actually, I think this month, they're deciding and going to stop, and they're going to be totally stationed out of North Bend. So anyway, that's just the comment.
Okay. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
They also have a mini facility now in Coos Bay. Not inappropriate. They're the Coast Guard. We rely on them for a lot of things, but these tankers are known in the homeland security industry as terrorism magnets because they are explosive with the right input, some shoulder-fired rocket or something on that order, on the level of dozens and dozens of Hiroshima-style bomb equivalents of TNT, really, really massive explosions could result from an attack on a tanker. So they have to be escorted by the Coast Guard in and out of the port out to deep water. And everything else has to shut down while that happens. So the proposal for Coos Bay is 90 tankers a year. It takes a day to turn around the loading and unloading, and that's 180 days a year when the predominantly time periods used by the fishing fleets will not be available to move their boats in and out of Coos Bay. They will be forced to either stay at sea or stay docked while the Coast Guard is escorting the tanker in and out. And that's a big deal, too, in terms of the supposed economic benefit of these things, because theoretically fishing can be a sustainable industry, and there's a lot of people who are trying to work toward that. Fossil fuels resource exploitation is not sustainable.
No, I mean, these, what's the lifetime of all these wells, of the gas industry itself, let alone, each individual well has a lot of them have a very limited lifetime. They run through them in a matter of years. Isn't that right?
No, that's not. I've heard on TV in advertisements that we've got a 100-year supply of natural gas. We don't ever have to worry about American energy security again. You must have gotten that. Oh, wait, it's because maybe you got that impression, Paul, because these wells tend to deplete after 8 or 10 years. And a single well can be fracked multiple times, but every frack requires on the order of 5 million gallons of water. And that water is either irretrievably polluted, they call that produced water when it comes back up, nice euphemism, or it's used to extinction, which is to say it stays underground and is permanently removed from the hydrologic cycle. And it, I think that in many ways, for the semi-arid West the fights that are going on to stop fracking in Colorado especially, but also in Utah, and hopefully someday in Wyoming, and all across the eastern U.S., water is, I think, the Achilles heel, because it's just crazy.
Yeah, well, we have a drought on, I believe, in large parts.
Again,
of,
sorry.
Well, large parts of California and the Southwest. There's an epic drought going on, and you know they finally, I guess, finally called the fracking industry to task for actually putting highly toxic water back into aquifers, which are so desperately needed now. Which they thought that's the thing. People think, oh, it's gonna go on forever. You know, this as we've come accustomed to the way of life that we're living. We're always going to have water. We're always going to have this. We're always going to have that. And it's apparently not the case. So we have two more callers. We only have 20 minutes, a little bit left. I just want to make the point that, you know, this is a very it's a vast and complex issue. We're talking about where the gas is coming from, how it is extracted on the site. We're talking about the vast network of pipeline that's already sprouted up, and more and more and more hundreds of miles plan to be added to it. We're talking about what the financial interests are behind all that. We're talking about where it's destined in Asia, the investors that are investing in this infrastructure. We're talking about export facility on our coastline, the dangers involved in that. So there's a lot to be looked at and examined, and it is vast and it can be overwhelming to people, but we'd like to thank Ted and his colleagues for kind of putting it all together again in this newly released pamphlet, Climate Impacts of Natural Gas Production and LNG Export. Could you just, before we, you know, so we don't forget, how can people get a copy of this? I did put one link to, I think, an earlier version of this that I found online in my cursory look, but how can people find this report?
So we've got it up on the Sierra Club, the Oregon Sierra Club website, okay, which is oregon.sierraclub.org. Pretty simple. We have a, and we need to do a better job with this, and you'll motivate me now to make that happen. But we have a good link to this, which is an 8-page report, and also to a one-sheet, two-page synopsis of the synopsis. On a blog post I did on September 23rd, this latest edition is November. We've added material to it, so that's the Sierra Club blog site is on the homepage. And so if you pop into that and then scroll down to September 23rd, you can grab both of these reports pretty easily. Plus, you'll see all sorts of other good stuff, just to shill for the Sierra Club for a minute.
And of course, Sierra Club is one of many groups that have come together on this issue. And I know there's a busload of people went down to this hearing at Roseburg. So, well,
they were awesome.
Well, keep that in mind. Let's go to one of our two callers that are waiting patiently, and then we'll get to the Roseburg hearing and as much else of this issue that we can before we have to go. Marilyn, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, fantastic program. And if we start to deal with the devil, we'll have to pay the devil. And if these people get their pipeline in our state, they will take over the politics, and their money will come in and buy our politicians and judges and schools and whatever else they want. So we got to keep them out.
Are they not already in place to some extent? That's just a provocative question.
They're not dominating. Yeah, they're not dominating the state like they're dominating Wyoming.
There you go. That's true. Yeah, that's a very important point. And same thing for the coal and oil interests. There's just seems to be this vast.
They crush democracy. Yeah. They crush the voice of the people, and they turn everything over to their profit machine. And they don't belong here.
I personally couldn't agree with you more, Ted.
Yeah, the fossil fuels industry is the only industry that is allowed to pollute as much as it wants in terms of atmospheric destruction with complete immunity and impunity. Any restaurant that tried to dump its garbage into the alley without proper containers would pretty quickly get a visit from some level of local government to point out that is a violation of all sorts of health codes and requirements. And we are at a point in time where the fossil fuels industry can no longer be treated as just another standard part of the economy. It is different, and it is not going to learn because their stock prices are completely dependent on keeping up with this carbon pollution. And so they know the deal. I mean, they're not, it's not like they're ignorant. It's not like they don't have scientists or that they dispute the science. They don't dispute the science. They all are integrating climate disruption into their own business plans for their facilities. They are moving coastal facilities. They are making them higher. They are providing on-site water in their drought area facilities. I mean, they are doing things so that they can be robust and resilient against the climate crisis while continuing to cause it. And it's wrong on so many levels. They need to be reined in on every level, local, state, regional, federal.
Did you have another comment, Marilyn?
Well, I just wonder if you need any volunteers.
Well, I can show for Sierra Club again, and so yes, so oregon.sierraclub.org, there's a volunteer button there. We would love to have your help. And there's a ton of good groups working on this. In the Portland area, Columbia Riverkeeper is the leading group fighting the Astoria-Warrenton LNG terminal and the oil trains. Lots of groups working on coal export issues, and now there's a strong coalition on converting the called coal to clean energy, trying to persuade PGE and PacifiCorp, especially PacifiCorp. PGE is only moderately bad on these things. PacifiCorp is terrible, and persuade them to get off of coal, dirty coal, and onto clean renewable energy. So my recommendation is that you think about what matters the most to you, what you care about the most, because there's lots to do for all of us. And then look for someone who's linked in on that and join your efforts to theirs.
Okay.
Thanks for your example.
And thank you for calling, Marilyn.
Thank you.
And I will link to all these on the page for this program, Wednesday Morning Talk Radio, under this date. And you can find out various links. There's also, 350.org. There's Rising Tide. There's a new group, the Climate Action Coalition, that's kind of trying to bring together a bunch of different groups on these issues. So there's other groups as well. So I will link to those groups. And they, all these groups have meetings, have offices, and are looking for people to get involved. So, with that, let's just go to our next caller. Pear, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. China and Russia have recently signed a $400 billion oil and gas deal. And what is that going to do to the market for this expensive gas from this part of the world?
That's a really good question and a very appropriate one. One of the most interesting things about the ramrod of Jordan Cove down the throats of Oregon, to get a little polemical here, is that Veresen Energy, the Canadian developer that is pushing this $5 to $6 billion project, does not have signed committed contracts with users in Asia yet. On the Gulf Coast, where there's three major LNG export proposals that have flipped from import that are on the path to completion, and there's one that is going to be completed for sure. It's too late to stop it. You know, they have got conditional contracts. And they announce them. I mean, they're proud. It helps their local investors. It helps their stock price. You know, it's all good in terms of globalized monopoly corporate capitalism. You want to tell people when you're doing well. Veresen has been silent on this question, and they just recently bought half of the Ruby pipeline that I discussed earlier from Wyoming to Malin, Oregon, and so there's a lot of speculation among us who are working on this as to exactly what their strategy is there. But it basically, they're betting on the come, with that if they build it, they will have such a cheap supply of gas that they'll be able to find users as gas use explodes around the planet, which is, of course, the industry's long-term plan.
Well, isn't...
I mean, up in B.C., they... the government there was pushing some kind of a similar project, and there's an article in a magazine in Vancouver called the Tie, and it told how this, you know, the Russia-China deal just would totally, you know, pull the rug out from under that deal. So it's just...
China's not the only user. South Korea, mm-hmm. Japan, you know, Japan has no hydrocarbons. They import all, and that's one of the reasons they went so big on nuclear, is they have to import all of their hydrocarbons. And it's a big global market, but the China-Russia deal really did shake things up.
I think that would include South Korea and probably Japan also. I mean, you know, China and Russia are talking big. They're talking about a kind of a giant, kind of a continental operation there, you know, from Tokyo all the way into Europe. I mean, they've got big plans.
And yes, but it is. I think it's mixed. And you know, Veresen hasn't withdrawn. I mean, they've probably spent something like $100 million so far on the Jordan Cove project and its pipeline planning. And it's not like they've said, oh, there's no. You know, we can't go on now because we don't have buyers yet. So they're betting on the come. They're pushing forward. So in terms of what we have to do in Oregon over the multi-year, we have about 18 months where this is going to either go down or go in. And in terms of the multi-year process for the new China-Russia deal and the other developments that are going on around the world, those are very important, and thanks very much for bringing it up, because you're certainly right that it's major, but I think that we need to be focused here on what we can do locally.
Oh, yeah, well, I would check out that article in the Tie. It's by an environmental writer named Andrew Nikiforuk. I don't know if you've heard of him.
Okay, well, thanks for calling, Parrott.
Yeah, okay.
And let's get to that issue of 18 months and the fact that these hearings, which we really haven't talked about yet, and I think we should, the hearings were basically called because the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is the federal agency involved in oversight for these projects, they issued their draft environmental impact statement. And so then they're soliciting comment, and there's comment both written and testimony at these hearings. But the finding, let's talk about the finding of that DEIS, which is apparently that there is minimal environmental impact from this project. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's nothing that can't be mitigated. I mean, disturbing five rivers and hundreds of water courses. And, you know, this pipeline, I mean, my favorite mitigation proposal out of this is that the mitigation, the economic mitigation for the loss of land that the 400-some landowners, ranches and private lands and homes and so on, old family farms, would suffer from the pipeline is commercial logging. They would get to sell the logs that would be ripped off of their land. This pipeline is a 36-inch explosive buried pipeline, there are a lot of issues with that, but it requires a clear cut the size of an interstate highway, and it's essentially an 8-lane clear cut that has to be maintained in perpetuity. It goes through old growth forest, it goes across some of the roughest country of the Coast Range, and it goes through crosses these rivers and goes through the farming areas of southern Oregon as well. But in the forest areas, you know, very, very disruptive to forest ecology to create these new edges, forest edges, they call them. And it's a permanent easement at a really low price. The issue of eminent domain is one that has really ignited protest here. There was a rancher who spoke last night at the Roseburg hearing, and he also spoke Monday night at the Coos Bay hearing. Brilliant guy who is furious about the fact that he has lost many of his traditional rights to manage his property. And some of that was done by Oregon legislation on behalf of the LNG industry, supported by a slim majority of the Democrats in the legislature and a strong majority of the Republicans, and quickly signed by Governor Kitzhaber in this prior term, removing protections for watercourses in terms of landowners having to sign off on permits being issued to third parties. So Verizon Energy, through Jordan Cove and the Pacific Connector Pipeline, it's called, have been able to get permits from the Department of State Lands to have watercourse impact. You know, Oregon's one of the few states where the people own all of the water, and that's so important to us, long-term, especially with the climate crisis. And the Department of State Lands manages the impacts on those water resources and watercourses. And so now they can do that, and they also are going to have eminent domain authority, which in the Constitution is limited to governmental purposes for the public good. Now, that's been modified by Supreme Court decisions, but it's really ugly for a lot of the people here in Southern Oregon.
And yeah, Richard Chasm, who we interviewed on the news yesterday evening, I was talking to him beforehand, and he was saying that he was told by, I don't know if it was a government official, I think, that, you know, he made that question, you know, there's some phrase about needs and necessities or something. You know more about that.
Public necessity.
Right. And he was told that it was for the needs of the pipeline company, that this eminent domain, which seems to be a serious, which I think a similar thing came up with the whole Trans-Canada, the whole KXL pipeline, and the fairly large opposition that came from landowners down there from Oklahoma to Texas, and is going to really come up if that does go through from the Native nations, who have an entirely different relationship with the federal government. So that'll bring up some interesting issues. But that whole issue of eminent domain, yeah, that's a kind of a hidden issue that comes up with these individual landowners, but it's really hasn't, that whole question of the public good really hasn't been revisited, you know, in a comprehensive way by the courts, has it?
Not here, in a way that we can really hang our hats on in a healthy way. And of course, property rights are a complicated question. I mean, we all want a common good approach, a commonwealth approach to what we all need in common, water, air, land over the long term, sustainable land. And Richard Chasm, whom you mentioned, I mean, he's been, he has a family woodlot that he lives on and has been managing sustainably for 40 years. And the canopy and the health of the trees is greater now than it was 40 years ago because he's done it sustainably without clear cuts, logging specific trees that allow the thinning that other trees then need to thrive. It's not rocket science, but it's terrific forestry.
So I take it he's in the way of this pipeline project. I take it.
He is not, his land is not directly in the way, but damage to the forest and the air throughout this region, he's just a couple of miles off it, and it affects everybody. And he really is, he's a good neighbor. I came down the other day from Portland, and he met me at a side of the road to guide me up to his place late Saturday night, and so I was waiting there in my little pickup with my flashers on and, you know, door open, standing outside. Two people stopped to ask if I needed help. So, I mean, this is a community of neighbors, and just like so many neighborhoods in Portland are, and it's what we all want.
So, Ted, I gotta interrupt you because we only have 3 minutes left. We have two callers. Uh-oh. Hopefully we'll get at least one of them. But I just need to mention that at 9 o'clock after this program, Angelica Lim and Joseph Gonzalez of the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines talk about For Whom We Rise Together, International Human Rights Day at Portland State University, which is an event happening this evening. And at 9:30, I'll be back to speak with KBOO reporter Yana Maximova, who is currently in Lima at the UN Climate Talk. So let's just get one more caller here. Harvey, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Paul, and thanks for the program, and thank you, Ted, for your great work. Fracking triggers earthquakes, and it turns out that the USGS, U.S. Army, said that fracking lubricates the fault lines. And next to the state is the state of California with the Diablo Canyon, and they're always told the big one's coming, and they're fracking, and we'll get a Fukushima. It's only built for 7.5, and Fukushima had a 9-pointer, and then you get all that water, radioactive water running into the ocean going up and down the coast, so all the desal plants up and down the coast will be sucking in radioactive salt water. So that's another reason to stop the fracking, and I want to thank you, Ted, for everything you're doing. It's so right.
Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you as well.
And maybe we could squeeze in our one last caller here. LJ.
Hey, good morning.
Got to make it really quick. We got two minutes left to wrap up.
To the point. Okay, here we go. The mile-long trains that carry that very volatile oil through the southeast section of town, and the small nuclear reactor at Reed College, and in case of a disaster, the ramifications of what might happen to the southeast.
Thank you, LJ.
Have a good day.
Okay, we were talking about, that is another issue, the oil trains, which we've covered on cable and will continue to cover. Today we're talking specifically about liquefied natural gas, export facility proposed for Coos Bay, the Jordan Cove facility, a series of hearings that our guest, Ted Gleichman, is attending this week. We got to run, Ted. So I'll just, again, refer people to our website, kboo.fm. Look at Wednesday Talk Radio. There'll be links to all the groups and reports. Climate Impacts of Natural Gas Production and LNG Export is the report that we've been talking about. Ted, thank you so much for appearing. You got any quick 20-second statement?
Stay tuned. We're not done yet.
All right.
We're still fighting.
So, thank you, Ted. Appreciate it. And
thank you, Paul.
Anybody listening online in areas or want to go down to any of these other hearings, they are happening. I actually do
and
not have that
tonight, then Medford, then Klamath Falls, then Malin.
Okay. Thank you so much. And this has been Paul Roland for Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much for listening. KBOO Portland.
goes back to 2005. Bush said gas drillers didn't have to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act before too long. It was frack, baby, frack until the break of dawn.
With the EPA out, it was up to the states, but they didn't have the money to investigate. Sick people couldn't prove fracking was to blame, all the while water wells were going up in flames.
Cause it's hard to contain all the methane released. It can get into the air, it can get into the streams. It's a greenhouse gas worse than CO2. Fracking done wrong could lead to climate change too.
Now it's not that drillers should never be fracking, but the current regulation is severely lacking. Reduce the toxins contained, the gas and wastewater, and the people will get sick and the planet will get hot.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on
K-B-O-O
Portland. Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
Hi, this is Sun Lee, the membership coordinator at KBOO Community Radio. I just want to take a moment to say thank you to all the people that made our three-day December drive a rousing success. From our volunteers that answered phones, created great programs, and engineered live music, and to all of our listeners that called in or donated online, and to the restaurants that donated food for our volunteers. I would also like to thank and welcome the 40-plus new members to the KBOO community. Without your support, KBOO would not be what it is today. Thank you.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning. Just coming up next, it's Angela Lin and Joseph Gonzalez of the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines today talking